Oh, when they were organizing this, I didn't know that I was going to talk at all, but Dennis wants me to talk about the circle game. It's appropriate. It's being reissued this year. I've spent some time trying to rewrite parts of it, and that's awfully hard to do, to get the free time to do it. But for my purposes, it's probably better to ask, why are they reprinting it? You can come up with a number of different answers. One reason is that I heard from my publisher, Thetis Books, who does the publication, that the circle game was on eBay, up for auction, and was up to $500. Somebody would pay $500 for this? They barely paid me that to write it. Yet they wanted a copy. Thetis says they had, 2,000 requests, standing orders for the book, which is funny because the original run was only 2,000 books. So I don't know what happened to those, but obviously it didn't get to 2,000 satisfied people. But anyway, people continue to want it, and somebody was willing to bid it up to $500. So I said, go ahead and reprint it. Now, just tell you a little history of the book. This is my book on residential schools. It was written originally for the Royal Commission. It was 1996, and I remember distinctly because my report for the 1994 original termination date was in on time. And they took 2 more years to find somebody else to write the report that actually appears on the residential school section of the Royal Commission report, because mine was supposed to be there, but they didn't like it. Why? Because it didn't say what they wanted it to say. So I don't think I was the only person who they found annoying in that sense, so they had to find a whole bunch of people to write sections for the embarrassingly accurate sections that had been submitted to be originally parts of the Royal Commission report. But it didn't come out until 1996. And I still remember the day that it was going to be announced because I spent the night before desperately downloading onto the Internet my copy of this under the idea that they weren't going to include the circle game as part of the official Royal Commission report. And I wanted, when people started searching on the Internet for the residential school section of the Royal Commission report, to get my report instead. So I wanted to get there ahead of time and have it online. Because what is in there is, in my opinion, treacle. It doesn't deal with the issues. And nothing that has happened since then has dealt with the issues, as I see them anyway. So the book actually came out on, New Year's Eve, 1997. So really, it's a 1998 book. And I've been thinking about revising it. The first problem with revising it was, A, did anybody want to see a revision? As far as I could tell, nobody had read the original. I mean, where the 2,000 copies went, I don't know. I know my mother must have had about 500 of them on her coffee table. She always would just say, oh, this, my son did this, oh, look. You know, the mailman comes by, oh, look at what my son did. So I figure she got 500 of them. I know I gave away a lot of copies. They sent me, when you write a book, they send you a few copies so that you can distribute them. And I guess you're supposed to send them to reviewers or whatever. I never did that. I just gave them away to friends. And I got 2 or 3 boxes of those. And it wasn't moving that fast. For reasonable reasons. I mean, a lot of people who've tried to read it told me it's very hard. And I said, yeah. So, nuclear physics is very hard, but a lot of people do nuclear physics. Biochemistry is very hard. A lot of people do biochemistry. Calculus is pretty hard. A lot of people take calculus courses. The fact that something's hard is no reason not to do it. But as far as I could see, also the people who had read it hadn't understood it. So I never saw a reason, really, for revising it very much. But this is the third reason not to revise. Is I got it all right. As far as I was concerned, it was already perfect. And the one change on that, one thing I would pull away from on that was I had reviewed the ADR stuff. In many ways, people, at least the bigwigs in Indian country, are very parochial. They tend to see the entire world in terms of is this an Indian thing? If it is, well, then it's relevant. If it's not, then I don't care. So here they were running into this ADR process, or the origins of it were back in the 1990s. But there's a large literature that preexisted anything that happened with respect to the residential schools of this alternative dispute resolution mechanism. Laura Nader, Ralph Nader's sister, had actually written by 1990, she had written 4 books on the topic. There was a simple literature search will pull up a good 300 articles on alternative dispute resolution before 1995. And the interesting thing about that literature is that every piece of that literature will tell you alternative dispute resolution won't work. It's a sham. It's a fraud. So since there wasn't anything available in the literature that said it was a good idea, I couldn't in my heart of hearts believe that anybody would have the nerve, the gall, the complicity to propose it and expect that it would make any headway into Indian country. So I had some of the literature research done. I just didn't put it in here because there didn't appear to be a point. And as we all know, there was a point. Because there are people just that duplicitous. There are people just that stupid working at the Assembly of First Nations and for the Department of Indian Affairs who decided that this was the route that they were going to go. And I wrote a paper that included some of the reference to the ADR literature, the pre-existing literature. That paper, one of the papers that's available out front, is a workup that I did with several of the people who are here today. Pierre was an author on that paper. Lisa was an author on that paper. They were students at the time. I like to tell students are just as smart as everybody else. You know, just go out and do the work. Don't believe that you have to have letters after your name to say something useful and important. But we put that paper together. And so now it's a supplement. So if you have this and you stick that other paper in, then you pretty well have everything. They still wanted me to do a revision, though, because about 2002, that's when they started at Thetis Press getting a lot of requests for the book. They ran out of the original 2000, and the requests started to build. So they wanted me to do a revision. And I did write a little introduction to it, and it starts very simply. It starts, "I told you so," and then it goes on to talk about these other things, because it's literally the case, if you go through the circle game, every stupid thing that's happened with regard to the residential school, I predicted it. I knew that if they didn't deal with it in a substantive way, in a meaningful way, in a human way, that eventually anything that the federal government did and the Assembly of First Nations approved would collapse under its own ignorance. And that's happening now. Just last summer, it's been a hiatus of about 2 or 3 years. It was about 2 or 3 years before anybody bothered to ask me to come and talk about residential schools, except, of course, around here, because some of you people actually read it, or you've heard that I've written a book, and let's get them to talk about it. But for about 2 or 3 years, I ceased getting any kinds of invitations to go out and talk about it. So, for example, last summer was the first time in 3 years that I've been even down home, down in Six Nations territory, where they asked me to come and talk about it. And then in February, I was in Ottawa talking about it for 2 days. And this coming June, I'll be in Vancouver for 3 days talking about it. Originally, when I got this request from Vancouver to come, I had to send them back an email saying, "Are you sure it's me you want to come?" And I got an email, "What do you mean by that?" I sent back another email. "Because you held a conference back in 2001 in which you sent me a letter saying that if I would be willing to pay for my own flight, to pay for my hotel, to pay for my meals, and to pay the registration fee, you would allow me to talk for 15 minutes at your conference on residential schools." And that was the same one at which you spent $20,000 to fly in Anglican Bishop Desmond Tutu, a man, by the way, who I hadn't seen had ever written one thing on the Indian residential school, but you're going to spend $10,000 on him and maybe another $10,000 in terms of his flight his accommodation, his limousine service, his butler service, and God knows what else, and probably waive his registration fee, to have him come up and tell you what I've already said was ridiculous, which is you should have a truth and reconciliation set of hearings there, just like we had in South Africa. By the way, that's exactly what he did. And, of course, they didn't do it, and it would have been a waste of time anyway. But, see, it's only cost them $20,000, $25,000 in order to do that. I said, you know, I was insulted in 2001 for you to say that somehow you were going to give me the privilege of talking about something that I put years of my life, my intellect into. I mean, thanks, but no thanks. I know an insult when I hear one. I'm that smart anyway. But so they said, well, we've moved on. And while we're having this conversation, by the way, is taking place over email. I said, yes, you've moved on, obviously. I didn't tell them this. But this is roughly the same time when that information came out that the ADR process had spent $125 million in the past 2 years. And of that, $124 million went into bureaucracy and in procedure, and that less than $1 million actually got into the pocket of any person who suffered through the horrors of the residential school. Who could have predicted it? Well, I predicted it. You bothered to read the damn book. You set up a bureaucracy in order to weasel out of your obligations and explain away crimes as mistakes and so on and so on and so on. It's all in the book. And, well, the group that had brought Bishop Desmond Tutu to Vancouver was one of the groups that had benefited materially out of the process of out of $125 million going into middle people. Well, you know, I'm the butler who's in charge of making the salad for the chauffeur who drives the man who wakes up the commissioner in the morning and gives him a towel after a shower. Oh, okay, well, then you get $1 million. This is an actual occurrence. A woman was awarded $3,000 for her abuse in a residential school. And among the things that had happened to her is that when she and her sister had run off, they had captured them and brought them back and then locked them for like 72 hours without food or water in a darkened room. And they awarded her for that $3,000 until they reviewed it. And they said, well, because you were locked in the room with your sister, you weren't isolated. And the lack of isolation meant that it wasn't really an abuse that you suffered. So we're taking back the $3,000. So here you, how many people made money out of that except for the victim? How many jurors or how many adjudicators sitting in consideration of those had made money? How many typists had made more money out of it than the little girls who had been locked in that room? How many cab drivers had made money out of that particular case as opposed to the people who actually suffered the indignity? So they were a part of that process, and now they were moving past it because the literature is turning bad. It started in 2001. In 2002, there was a letter by some of the lawyers calling ADR an absolute fraud. I was going to incorporate it into the chapter that Pierre and Lisa and Andrea and a few of us others had written, except that it was a confidential letter and I wasn't supposed to quote it. I don't know if it's been released by now. But again, it seems to dawn on people way, way too far after the fact that these things are not meant to deal with the issues. They are meant to avoid dealing with the issues. And if you can avoid dealing with the issues and pay yourself for avoiding dealing with the issues, then you've got one heck of a strategy. That's exactly what you want to achieve. The First Nations people who have been involved in this bogus process of therapeutic intervention and so on, I don't hold them as blameworthy as I would, let's say, the churches or the government or the formal therapists. I'm a psychologist. And as a psychologist, I knew darn well that it was a fraud and a sham. What I specialized in abnormal psychology. I took a clinical internship for 2 years. I've gone through the DSM-4, I don't know how many times, the DSM-3. Do you know what? There's no such thing as residential school syndrome in there. There's no such thing as conciliation therapy in there, and so on and so on and so on. They just sort of, oh, well, if they see a buck, they go after it. I'm a psychologist. I learned. Unless you can find a billable problem, you won't get paid. So of course you're going to call. Well, can you fix this? Well, of course I can. Give me a week and I'll come up with the DSM-5. That will include it and allow me to bill the Canadian government for it. I like to tell the story back at the beginning when they started doing therapy for residential school survivors. It cost, $100 a session for 20 sessions. And psychologists existed that could cure residential school syndrome in 20 sessions. It's stress-related disorders. And not only that, acculturation stress, they want to include it under that. But there's a couple other ones that we fall into, supposedly. So there's an entire category called acculturation stress, which means if you feel pressure to conform to if you're a minority person and you feel pressure to conform to a mainstream society and you don't do a very good job of adjustment, then you have a problem. And a psychiatrist or a psychologist can charge you for it. So we all suffer from acculturation stress, but post-traumatic stress disorder is also something they cover underneath that. But, like I was saying, they claim to be able to cure it in 20 sessions when MSB would pay for 20 sessions, and then MSB claimed it would only pay for 14 sessions, and what a great discipline I belong to. We found that we could cure it in 14 sessions. And then they said, well, we're only going to allow you to bill for 10 sessions. My God, we got on the case, and now we can cure it in 10 sessions. We are so good. I would never suggest to anybody go and talk to a psychologist. I repudiate my background in psychology. I mean, all I can say is for you to read the book, because what I find is that the psychologists have been duplicitous in the sham that has been foisted off on Indigenous people. Here, Canada and the churches in concert commit genocide against Indians. They commit genocide against Indians, and somehow, to deal with it, because a genocide is a crime in real criminal law, to deal with it, however, giving money to somebody else, a psychologist in this instance, is supposed to undo the crime. You know, suppose I rob a bank and I get caught and the RCMP says, well, we're going to take you in. I say, wait. I'm going to give my friend Bob here $25 out of the money I stole. That'll make everybody feel better. And if the RCMP said, oh, fine, good. Would you say the RCMP out of their mind? I would. But we're supposed to believe that the Canadian government paying a psychologist is supposed to undo the fact that the government and the churches were complicit in a crime of genocide against us. How does making psychologists and lawyers richer supposed to make me feel better as somebody who's gone through a residential school? I don't understand that. And if somebody says, well, they're there to help you, I would say, give to me what you're going to give to the lawyers and what you're going to give to the psychologists, and I'll take care of myself. Because I will try to, maybe I do have some problems associated with my experiences. Why does somebody else who has absolutely no understanding of it, how are they supposed to be more helpful and more knowledgeable about these areas? Do you know that the Native psychologists in Canada, but I don't know that they do anymore, but at one time we used to get together on a yearly basis, all six of us. So when you say, oh, 124 out of 125 million ADR dollars have gone to therapists and whatever, let's assume that $25 million went to psychologists. There can't be that much of the money going to Indian psychologists even, because there's simply not that many of us. And not only that, people often say, oh, well, I introduce myself as a psychologist. They say, oh, you're an Indian psychologist. I always have to say, no, there is no such discipline as Indian psychology. I am a psychologist who happens to be an Indian, And I was taught the prejudices of the discipline. I was taught the biased testing methods of the discipline. I was taught to think like within the frameworks of that particular discipline. And that discipline is the discipline that thinks it's a good idea that they get money to expiate the crime of genocide committed on Aboriginal people by the churches and the government. They're complicit. They're making money. And at that point, I realized that my job was to not be a psychologist anymore. I know psychology. I even teach psychology from time to time. But I do not teach this victim-blaming, oh, it's all in my head kind of psychology that you get from Dr. Phil and Oprah. Psychology may have a use, but certainly not the psychology that the mainstream has developed and foists off, not just on Indians. They do it to everybody. Dr. Phil and Oprah don't typically talk to Indians on television. They talk to whoever it is that whoever is calling up who thinks that they can do something useful for them. That's always been the status of First Nations, that we are various kinds of cash cows. The fact that it's been settling into the social sciences in recent years is only the latest manifestation of it. Those of you who are at least as old as I, and maybe a little bit older than me, will remember the time when there were literally no businesses at all on Indian reserves. And that was a very deliberate policy, because they would say, look at all the money we're giving to Indians, look at all the money they're giving to Indians. Well, what do? Just make chairs out of the piles of money that we're supposedly getting, put it into the fire and burn it for heat? No, if you get money, you have to spend it for it to be any use whatsoever. So the mainstream government knew a long time ago that all you're doing is using the Indians as a conduit for giving money to yourself. So if we drop $1 million into a Knight of the Thames Reserve, they don't sit on $1 million. They go to this grocery store and they buy groceries. They go to this gas station, they buy gas. They go to this coal company and they buy coal. And so on and so on and so on. And $1 million is gone. It only takes one remove, because it doesn't have to pass through any hands other than one Indian hand in order for it to get into a non-Indian pocket. Now, that's how the game works in the therapy areas now. Oh, there are lots of Indians who are getting in on that game, but remember that it's been a subtext of a lot of what people have been saying the last 2 days, is that this assimilationist attack is a very subtle one, and it emphasizes individual achievement and individual personal well-being and self-aggrandizement. So a lot of the people who can convince themselves that they're helping First Nations peoples therapeutically are also doing very well financially. So that's another reason that I did not get involved in any of the supposed therapeutic work coming out of the residential school. One, because I don't think that anybody is sick. And two, because it was blood money. Yeah, we're a cash cow. And the government systems are cash cow for government systems, but it's part of a general assimilationist attack for us to start thinking about our own personal self-satisfied well-being as the be-all and the end-all, rather than what is the stability of my nation, what is the longevity of my nation, what is the well-being of my peoples. When we take that as uppermost in our mind, and well, the fact that we're doing a little bit worse, a little bit better than somebody else is neither here nor there. But instead, well, we've got the situation where we're behaving like white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. And this becomes the test for how advanced and civilized we're becoming. The more we behave the way our oppressors behave, then the more civilized we're becoming. We've proven our ability to govern ourselves. Oh, we prove our ability to govern ourselves by having parliaments and band councils and votes and secret ballots and corruption. I mean, when we behave like the Kray-Chan government, we're there. What's the difference between a band council and giving money to bogus ad agencies for the unification of Canada that turns into deluxe boxes at a hockey game? What's the difference? The only difference is that a band council can't rip off as much to as large extent as a government can. But it becomes a a test of how civilized we have become when we behave like our oppressors. Now, let's just get back to this because we're kind of sidetracked there. The circle game. If you read through the circle game, I didn't do it because I expected to win law cases. There's a lawyer that I have an anonymous dialogue with in the preface. That's Paul. The fellow I've known for more years than I care to remember. But I sent him a copy of the book when it was still in manuscript form, and he called me up on the phone and said, well, there's no provision for enforcement or remedy in international law. I said, Paul, you idiot. What do you think? I'm making the case because I'm trying to make a case in international law? He says, well, you know, also, this doesn't help me prepare cases. I said, Paul, it's not my job to make your job easier. I bring it up because I'm hoping against hope that the average Canadian will read what their government did in their name to human beings to say that what their churches did to human beings in their name, because the churches aren't going to tell them. Their government is not telling them. They will not allow the word genocide to come up in discussion. Read through, and I did read through the whole damn transcript of the Royal Commission report and a whole bunch of pages of that are the unpublished that didn't make it into the five-volume set. The word genocide comes up 4 times. And when the word genocide comes up, it's not responded to. It's treated as if it's a rhetorical flourish on the part of the speaker. And it's just brushed right over. Well, thank you very much for your presentation. Now we're going to go on to some. This man just made a criminal charge against the Canadian government, and we're going to ignore that. We're not going to run that to ground. The churches, the United Church? The United Church met here a few years ago. And we have this on film with me trying to get the moderator of the United Church. I've got a copy of the United Nations Genocide Convention. Please, please, just admit you did this. Just admit it. And what we have him saying is over and over again, well, we can't say that because it's too strong a word for our parishioners to deal with. Now, that's an interesting concept. Genocide is not too strong a thing to do to people, but it's too abrasive a word for the sensitive parishioners who have to be kept in ignorance about what the church did to people, again, in their name, as good United Church members, as good Anglicans, as good Catholics. We can commit genocide, but then as good Anglicans and Catholics and Presbyterians, we can't admit it. We can't actually use the word. We can't allow the word to be used. When I wrote the book, I hoped against hope, and by the way, it wasn't a lot of hope, but I hoped against hope that it would become a bestseller and Steven Spielberg would turn it into a multi-million dollar movie. But that they would read it and they would see that I make a cogent case. I start from page 1 and I go to the page 90-something, and every time I go off on a slight tangent, I stick it in a footnote because I don't want people to be taken away from the idea. We have to see this right from the beginning. It's a series of dominoes that you push the first one over, and what you get at the end is another crime. You get the crime of genocide being covered up, so you now have a double crime. People who didn't commit the first crime are committing the second. And we're talking about just the newspaper saying 50 people a month are dying who have a claim on the residential schools. Maybe all the Canadian government's hoping is we'll temporize, and if we do that long enough, they'll all be dead. And the word will never come up, and we can give them these dismissible $3,000 settlements, and that will be that. I didn't want to go to the government to try to make this point. I didn't want to go even to the Indian organizations. I didn't want to do it myself, but I did hope that the Indian organizations would pick it up, would say, you know, this is good PR. to be able to go out and show the Canadian public that Canada has systematically distorted what genocide is by implementing only certain aspects of it under their own law, that the churches won't admit it, and so on and so on. The idea is that I've met a lot of Canadians. They're not rabid, warmongering murderers. They tend to be reasonable people. If you can get their attention and keep it long enough to make your case, they can understand. They may not agree with you eventually. I don't know how many Anglicans I've talked to who say, we'll come to the point of saying, yes, okay, we did commit genocide. The next words out of their mouth sometimes is very disappointing. But we can't afford to take responsibility for it. At which point I say, ah, so you're more like the Ford Motor Company than you are a moral organization. Is that there's one other thing that somebody who's truly repentant does. They not only own up to what they do, and they say, we're not going to do it again. They say another thing, and that is, and we will undertake to undo the harm as best we can. There's one other step. And that is, if I've done an injury to you, either willingly or unwillingly, wittingly or unwittingly, if I've done an injury to you, when it's called to my attention, I should say, I'm sorry. Either I didn't know, if that's the case, I didn't know what I was doing, or I knew what I was doing, and I don't understand myself, why I behaved in such an unsupportable manner. I undertake never to do this again. But I undertake one more thing, and that is, I will undo that injury as much as that injury can be undone. You don't get any of that from the Canadian government. You don't get that from the churches, which is why I don't consider churches moral organizations, and why I don't consider psychologists moral, because they're benefiting from other people's misery and the misstatement of the issues that are associated with it. That makes psychology, at best, pimps. That's what it makes them. So, with all that in mind, Circle Games coming out again. I suspect that it's had more impact on actions in Canada than I know. I know that in 1997, the federal government had a secret report that recommended to the government of the time that they own up and start paying off very quickly, because a gigantic bubble was about to burst that would throw them into utter disarray, and that the federal government decided not to go that route, but to go to the route of, no, let's blame the victim, call them all sick, and offer them psychotherapy, and maybe we'll get away with it. Now, whether or not this was supposed to be the pin that broke the bubble, I don't know, because this was, again, in circulation since 1994, the government, which, by the way, I sent copies to them. When I finished writing the Circle Game, I just didn't hand it over to the royal commissioners. I sent copies to all the major churches and to the federal governments and to provincial governments. I don't know what they did with it. I suspect that somebody in the federal government did eventually read it and got scared. Because the bottom line is that Canada did do something unconscionable. And if the average Canadian, again, I have to emphasize this, the average Canadian seems to me to be more a decent human being than otherwise. If the average Canadian understood what's done in his or her name to other human beings, they'd get as mad as I. I don't believe, for example, that racism is a personal, interpersonal animosity. I believe it's driven by profit motive. The idea is that Canada has stolen Canada from us, from the Mi'kmaqs and Maliseets out here, from the Iroquois and Southern Ontario and New York State, and so on and so on and so on. They reason the way any greedy, unscrupulous person would reason. And that is, if I was in their position, what would I do to me? I'd take them for everything they got. So that's what the Indians will do if we own up to our responsibility and to our actual actions. Because we did steal Nova Scotia. We did steal New Brunswick. We did steal 90%+ of Quebec, and so on and so on and so on and so on right across Canada. And that if the Indians can make a case that they really have suffered an injury and they can get us into front of a friendly, get themselves in front of a friendly court to them, we'll be paying them off forever. We can't, there's not enough money in the world to pay off what we owe of the people that we've stolen this property, this territory, these resources from. So we can't allow that to happen at all. You know, it's funny because I've never met a First Nations person, and that includes me, and I tend to be a fairly rabid one, that has decided that what should come out of all of this is that heads should roll and people should be imprisoned and that land should be wholesale turned back to Indians, that all the non-Indians should have to get on boats and sail back to Europe. Nobody's ever, that's never been a position that I've ever heard come out of an indigenous person in this country. And yet that's the kind of attitude that is imputed to us by those people who've committed those injuries and put themselves in the situation of what I would do if I had those people in that position. I'd take it all. I would litigate right to the end. I'd steal everything I could. I'd get it all back. I'd imprison them and so on. But that really, what's the first step in this is acknowledging what they actually did. And if afterwards, if I could honestly and sincerely feel a heartfelt apology from the people who did this, and then the statement that, and we now undertake with complete open eyes and with absolute integrity to make it as right as we can, I'd say then now we have something to do. Now we have a program of work. We're no longer going to sit around and bellyache about this and bellyache about that. Notice how quickly they love to adopt this. We need to turn the page on this. We need to turn the page on this. I keep saying, but I'm still reading. Let us finish reading that page and let us agree on what that page says. I'm willing to turn a page, but you're thumbing through it like those bad segues in movies, you know, where the pages of the book go back like this and, oh, we're moving forward in time now. They don't want us to read what's on the page. A lot of the reasons why indigenous peoples themselves will get involved in the process of participating in this sham, it's not because they're evil people either. It's because, like every other person living in this part of the continent, whether you want to call it Canada, whether or not we want to call it Canada, they're subject to the same limitations in terms of the presentation of history, the presentation of context, the understanding of the dynamic forces that are driving it. It's always easier to take something. I put a material condition at the beginning of all of this, and that is it's a lot easier to just assert that you own the land when you can pretend that the people who owned it weren't people. We don't sign treaties with moose. We don't sign treaties with squirrels. We don't make arrangements with mosquitoes. So New Brunswick is ours because it was empty. Oh, well, now those things that we used to think of as moose can actually read and write and talk, and they're saying that we trampled on their rights. And if we agree with them, because according to our adversarial legal system, it will mean that they will be able to seek a remedy in law. Oops, we can't allow that to happen. See, the Canadian government decided a long time ago wasn't going to shoot us all like they tried down in Tasmania or in the United States. But they did say, no, we've got to get them to behave like good Canadians. They have to accept their place in a political economy, and an organization of society that isn't theirs. They have to do it our way. And that includes stop talking about you being the real owners of this land. Stop talking about this as in terms of you having your own traditions, your own religions, your own cultures, your own practices, your own sovereignty. Stop talking that way. Every time you talk that way, You give us a feeling in the pit of our stomach that really makes us sick. So stop talking that way. So, you know, the book coming out again, and the fact that everything else again has failed. ADR is just another long list of failures to deal with substantively with the issues of genocide in Canada. I can hope, again, that maybe people will mature. One of the difficulties, of course, is that it's so easy to make up a disorder, place it in somebody else's head, and then convince them that you can cure it for a fee, that we've been doing that over and over and over and over again in psychology. It's one of the reasons why we're at the head of the line that's lining up at the feeding trough, is that we can assure people over and over again that we have this capacity, we have this knowledge. And what does the psychologist know about the history? What does the psychologist know about the political economy? Nothing. All they know is how to blame victims. And I don't want any victims on either side. I want a very clear understanding of the issues. And then let's address the issues. And once those issues are addressed, then we can talk about how do we make it right. So I hope that's the upshot of the book being released again. I know that it's not just this. I'm writing a book on introductory psychology, too. Why? Because introductory psychology conditions us to believe that the problems are north of the neck and that some mystic person can reach in there and take out what the problem is and put the right thing in or whatever. It's kind of like dipsticks of the mind. Oh, no, you've got a little bit too much anxiety, so we'll put that back in there and we'll put the right fluid in and you'll be fine. I'm going to write a psychology book that still talks about these kinds of issues but doesn't do so in a way that finds a way to blame the victims over and over again in the hope that maybe there'll be a group of people who won't think that Dr. Phil and Oprah have the answer to all the world's problems and that we can actually get to the position where now we have an issue to discuss. Let's do it as reasonable human beings. I guess my urgency about it, and I agree there's an urgency, my urgency is, in that sense, really quite arrogant and personal. I mean, for one thing, I studied to be a psychologist 11 years. I want those 11 years back. I mean, it's nice that I was able to figure out that they were pulling my leg. I'm kind of ashamed to admit that for 11 years while learning and then 3 or 4 years as practicing, I still hadn't figured it out. I'd like that time back. Then add it to the end. However, you give me back that time, I need it. There's that scene in Schindler's List toward the end where they're saying goodbye to him. He's leaving in the car. And he's saying, I could have done more. I could have done more. And he says, I've got a ring. I could have saved 2 people with this ring. Why did I keep this ring? I could have done more. It's a very emotional moment. It's a very emotional thing for me. I feel that as a psychologist, I've done harm. And I feel a responsibility to undo that harm. And if somebody says, well, Roland, you got, 5 more years on the planet before you're dead, I'd say, I could have done more. That's my sense of urgency. It's a very, an arrogantly personal one in that it took me a long time. I think I have a clear view. I try to share that clear view, and it's a difficult one to apprehend. I'm absolutely sure that it is, and it's intentionally so, because everybody deserves to make this realization themselves. It's not a gift that somebody can give you because you haven't done the work for it. We esteem too lightly that which we obtain too easily is a really important saying in my point of view. And that if people can reach this position themselves through hard work, then it's theirs to run in the direction that they want to do with as they want, because it's not my understanding, it's not my realization. It's different from the one the government and the churches would have me believe. And I have a responsibility because for the longest time I did nothing. I contributed to the problem. And this is my penance, is that I'm going to write that psychology book before I die. I'm going to write my book on suicide before I die. I'm going to write my book on racism before I die. And I won't feel comfortable until that happens, because that's the only way I have right now for atoning for my part in this disaster. That's kind of what I want to get across to the average Canadian. You have a responsibility, average Canadians. I say in the book, under international law, not only not to commit genocide and these other crimes that were committed against us, but as a human being, you have a responsibility not only to reject, refuse to participate in the unlawful orders of your government, you have a responsibility to resist it. That's all I have to say. Thank you.